welcome to the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, usually behind the microphone in the studio, but today glad that I'm here with this great team of thought leaders. And also, this is our first live taping of the podcast, so we will do mistakes. On my left, I have Luca Ancheschi. Dr. Luca Ancheschi is the professor of Central Asian Studies at the Glasgow University. And we have Dr. Jennifer Murtazashvili. She's the Director of International Development Programs at the University of Pittsburgh. And then we have Nomahar Imamova. She's the broadcaster and producer at the Uzbek service of Voice America. And Bruce Panier joining us from Prague, who's the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog that's called Kishlok Owozi. And we are here to discuss the latest developments in Uzbekistan, the biggest Central Asian story of last year. The discussion also coincides with almost 2 years since the administration change in Uzbekistan. The new leader in town is Shavkat Mirziyoyev, who since taking the office created some sort of momentum among his own citizens and also around the world. During the breakfast today, I was talking to one of my own colleagues, and she's from Kyrgyzstan, and she was saying that there might be lots of questions about what's happening in Uzbekistan, but one thing is surely changing, that is tension is easing in Central Asia. So I believe also true is he has taken steps to improve the country's economic stagnation and relax the borders, to some extent softened government's grip on freedom of media, and all are really positive points. But there are people who think that these steps are mostly cosmetic. For example, changes yet to reach to political pluralism and serious administrative judicial changes yet to take place. In other words, these are like barely a modernization, not a real liberalization that's taking place. So the question is, what is really happening in Uzbekistan? What to call it? And what are changing, what are not changing, what are the prospects for further changes? These are the questions we would like to discuss. Before to start, just a couple of housekeeping notes. I will kick off the discussion with a couple of questions, but what I will try to do today is to make this about you. I would like to hear more questions from you. And the other note is we would like to keep this limited to 1 hour. So I think, Dr. Murtazashvili, you are our host, and you deserve the first question. So you've just been to Uzbekistan. I believe it was your first trip after a long time.
I've actually been 3 times this year.
So tell us, please, what's changing?
So there's enormous changes taking place there. And I should just say, by way of background, I lived in Uzbekistan for 5 years, from 1997 to 2002. And like many of us, had a difficult time getting back to the country after many years. The changes that I've seen have been quite startling and surprising. And I think that the changes are quite real. I think there's what we're seeing is the beginning of a series of reforms. The government is intent on reforming, but how it wants to reform, I think it doesn't know itself. There are lots of things happening in Tashkent, lots of discussions, lots of new laws, lots of decrees. If you go down to the subnational level, though, you don't see as much evidence of the reforms because the reforms are inchoate. Yeah. They're not yet fully formed. So President Mirziyoyev has talked a lot, and I think what we should take away from what he said is that his message is not for the international community. Much of his message is domestic and it's an internal. It's about talking about problems. If you watch Uzbek television, you'll see some pretty significant changes in terms of what's being reported and how it's being reported, and people talking about problems and issues in ways they couldn't talk about before. President Mirziyoyev has also talked, I work on governance issues, and he's talked quite a lot about decentralization. He's talked about electing hakims. He's talking about reforms before they're actually happening. And I think that is quite significant. Why is it significant? Because it's raising expectations of citizens that further changes will happen. And if he doesn't deliver on those changes, that's on him. He's the president. He's been president for 2 years. So dealing with government officials in Tashkent, they are hungry. They are eager. I've met with many government officials and done seminars for them on different issues, not because I plan to do seminars, but because when I'm in Tashkent, they say, we want to decentralize authority. Can you help us? Can you give us models? Can you share with us information? This has been shocking and astounding to me. So they're not quite sure where they want to go. And I think old habits also die hard in terms of how reforms are implemented and how models are envisioned. But I do think that this is quite significant.
Also, the other note is, if anyone on the panel wants to respond to comment made by other panelists, please do so. So, Nobahar, first thoughts on some of the areas that are changing, and also some of the areas that are not changing.
So I fully agree with you that the reforms are real. I mean, Uzbekistan is changing, but we have to keep in mind that the real reform process actually started about a year ago, because it took a while for the government to actually come up with a reform agenda and get in sync, I guess, relatively in sync with itself about how it wants to move forward. So the immediate changes you notice are basically when you are in public, with the public, with the people. People talk about local politics all the time. There's a conversation about politics. Now, politics is a very primitive, you know, thing for Uzbeks, and they're not necessarily talking about political competition, but they're discussing how to solve issues, you know, what are the possible solutions, who's saying what. People are getting to know their local leaders, and that's a huge change for me. You know, they are trying to figure out ways to hold them responsible. So one of the first things that the government introduced was this virtual cabinet, where you could essentially petition, you know, send a petition to the government or to the relevant authorities to solve an issue that you have been struggling with. And that system worked pretty effectively for the first year. Now it has slowed down. So when I was in Uzbekistan in the summer of 2017, it was all about Partal. You know, how are people working with this virtual cabinet, and how it had become a problem-solving machine to an extent. And that was quite educational for the citizens, too. Basically, what Mirziyoyev did was he changed the tone, and that momentum is still there. There is that high spirit that was generated from the new tone. But now, what do you do with it? How do you make sure that that tone now translates into enduring reforms and don't necessarily become just cosmetic? There are some changes that are cosmetic, that are being just done for the sake of PR. But when it comes to reforming, let's say, the media environment, the change is slow, but they're real. I have spent probably 70 to 80% of my time in Uzbekistan, now that I've been traveling there as an accredited reporter, with state media and with what we call new media, cool media, like Kun Uz, Daryo Uz, and very recently Turan 24. Everybody wants training. Pretty much every chief editor, and we're talking about, you know, deeply rooted bureaucrats here. Not necessarily professional journalists. They want training. They want to uplift their, expertise. They want complete change in their newsrooms. They want to set up new kind of news operations. They want to be active on social media. They want to do a lot, and they don't necessarily see any kind of restrictions to do that. What has changed is not nobody still dares to criticize the ultimate power, you know, who is the president. And the government is still the president himself, and that is a fundamental problem. Internet, I mean, to put it mildly, it's in a terrible shape. To connect to the world is very difficult, even when you're in Tashkent. And the summer was awful. You couldn't get on Facebook. Uzbekistan was celebrating its Independence Day. Nobody was on social media. And those are very frustrating factors. And the government realizes that it is actually also suffering from these fundamental problems. Blocking the internet hurts the government more than ever. There are a lot of fundamental issues that haven't actually started being resolved, and those are frustrating. But the tone and the momentum is still there, and it's really up to some people, I would argue, in the government to make those tough decisions.
Okay, two quick points on that, Nobahar. One is the things that you mentioned, especially the internet, why it's not changing. I mean, if Mirziyoyev wants to change it, he can change it, right? He has no challenger.
So they blame the infrastructure.
The second is about media that you spoke about. Only you have accreditation. I remember when BBC dispatched its reporter, filed application for accreditation in Uzbekistan, we had a baby. Now he's walking, and BBC is still waiting for accreditation. Why? I mean, he can do it.
They started the process in late 2016. I mean, it's a shame, really. And I will tell you this. I mean, as a Western-based journalist, one of the things that I'm pushing when I'm in Tashkent is for this. You have to let our colleagues from the RFRL, from the BBC Uzbek service, come in. You need that. You have to. And you know what's happening is this. The government has a list of excuses to justify why the process has been slow. They will very quickly tell you that they have never denied that them yet. They, when I was there in July and recently in September, they were asking me about what the RFRL is doing about this. How come? We had their chief editor from Prague, they came over, you know, President's press secretary met him, he met with the head of the Uzbek National News Agency, which wants to work with RFRL, where the process is. Basically, the government says they're not being proactive. They're not seeking the accreditation actively. They're not fully engaged with us. They're keeping us in the dark. We don't know what they want. That's what they say about the RFRL. When it comes to the BBC, they say it's very complicated because BBC wants a lot of things at the same time. We can't accommodate all of them, you know? And I think one of the perhaps, you know, a strategic decision that we made, that the Voice of America was obviously, was we don't want the bureau. We are not hiring any local journalists. We want access to Uzbekistan. I just want the doors to be open, and that's all we need. That was a smart move. Maybe it took them a month to respond to my accreditation, and I had the accreditation by the end of March, but it was announced when President Mirziyoyev was visiting Washington. But we need to continue pushing the government. They want to be pushed. And we have to continue also shaming them when it is necessary. We have to say, you know what, internet sucks in Uzbekistan. You cannot attract investment when you don't have the basics on the ground. It's just water and electricity for Uzbekistan. Now, the people in government need that from us so that then they can go and vouch for their own interests.
Dr. Murtazashvili, you want to say something, but just to be clear, RFRL has indicated what it wants. Authorities really know what we want. I spoke with the ambassador a couple of times, but something is stopping them from going forward. That's a different story. I don't like RFRL to be on the table today. So, yeah, please go ahead.
So I think when we have to say, you know, Mirziyoyev is the president and the president can decide, President Karimov was president for 25 years. He consolidated authority over a long period of time, and that's how he was the president, had the authority to do many things. I think it's very easy for us to forget that Mirziyoyev is new. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes and how bargains are taking place. And it's very interesting to see that one of the first sectors that was opened up to reform was the justice sector and looking at internal security services. And I think there's good reasons for that. If you look at the internal political dynamics and potential rivals to the president internally. So we don't know what's going on. We don't know what kinds of debates are happening behind the scenes. And that's also because it's still top-down reforms from an authoritarian regime that's trying to reform itself. And I think what we're seeing being played out is they're figuring this out as they're going along. So just as you can't take the media sector in a vacuum, there was a new NGO law that came out in May, and there are still NGOs that this new law came out, but still NGOs are having a hard time registering because it's taking time to figure all of this out, the implementation issues. You can pass a law and pass a decree, and the government's passing decrees with rapidity, right? There are new decrees coming out every single day, but implementing things is really challenging. And so I think the issues, it's not just the media sector. You're seeing it happen in quite a few sectors.
Can I add something to that, Mohammed? You know, you referred to the power struggle, right? I mean, President Mirziyoyev is very much in charge. He continues to consolidate power. But what has changed also, this is one of the really important changes for Uzbekistan, is that now there is a clash of interests in Tashkent. Like, there are people lobbying for their own interests. The inner struggle within the government, it's not like they want to push him down. He's very much in charge, and he has the National Security Service very much under control, and all is well on that front. But now everybody wants to get his attention, to get the kind of decisions that they want him to make. And you actually see that struggle. And the fact that recently, you know, the press secretary of President Mirziyoyev, Kamel John Alamjanov, was pushed out is a product of that clash. He was pushed out by those within his circle, within Mirziyoyev's president's, you know, surrounding, who don't want the government to move that fast.
Yes. Yeah. It's trying to build consensus.
At least I'm not prepared to give Mirziyoyev so easy pass. I believe that he's given easy pass in many ways, but he is and was part of the regime. In this or the other way, from last couple of years and decades, one of the top person ruling this country as a prime minister. So whatever wrong with the administration, he is part of that. Sorry to say this. Dr. Luca, talking about the changes, motivation, I was reading the analysis by Dr. Edward Lemon, friend of us. He nicely described the changes in Uzbekistan in two words. And he's saying, indeed, there is a change in the air, but that change is a modernization, not a liberalization. So whatever happening today in Tashkent, what to name it, what to call this?
Well, I have this research project at the moment that compares what happened in Turkmenistan in the first 2 years of the post-Niyazov time with what is happening now in Uzbekistan in the first 2 years of the post-Karimov time. And the idea, I mean, the hope was that I could explain why the two landscapes reacted to change in two different ways by looking at how power was transferred first and then how the elite was managed in the first 2 years. And unfortunately, to say that I didn't get that result with mine. But I then decided to focus for my, you know, for my publication on that, on the first two issues, looking at change just for my own interest, really. And I've noticed, and, you know, I'm friend with Ed, so I came up with modernization first than him. And I noticed that what is happening in Uzbekistan, and I have to admit, I haven't been recently, so I haven't got the feel that you have, seems to me much more a process that intends to modernize the local authoritarianism rather than liberalizing that. So it, to put it in a sort of more unsophisticated way, the more I look at Uzbekistan now, the more I see Kazakhstan, in the sense that I'm seeing a controlled opening with a strong leader who, I have to disagree, is in control. If you look at policy decisions.
You agree that he is in control.
He is.
Yeah, he is in control.
But I haven't finished yet. So he is in control and is pushing a number of reforms, control opening, economic opening, attracting a lot of investment if he can, EBRD loans, human rights watch is coming in. I'm not saying he's committing. I'm saying he's controlled. And this, to me, is what Kazakhstan is all about. This is the kind of nicer, softer, less brutal, more open, relatively globalized, non-democratic politics that we've seen there. Now, the long-term perspective is that if there is this kind of stability brought by this new leader in control, long-term it would be unstable, not in the kind of dramatic way, because the only thing that bring long-term stability is human rights and liberalization. And there is not much of a discussion about that. And I haven't really seen any kind of discourse. I hear him saying, it's not you serving the secret services, but it's secret forces that are serving you. I'm seeing talking about the judge. But it's a change of tone, but we haven't really seen. Now, and the last thing, and then I just want to talk for a bit. There is also, and I think this is a Western problem, fascination with sudden reformers. Two examples. The first one, unfortunately, is Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. A couple of years ago, he was everywhere. This is the new guy, and you know, he's bringing reform. The women are driving. It is all very, very important, but he hasn't followed up, and we got to the point in which we are now. Eritrea, Ethiopia, they're changing in different ways. Here we have people who are saying we need to have election. The former regime was corrupt. I haven't seen that. So for me, it's... there are three issues on the table. The first one is that there is a change, and we can't argue against that. The second one is admitting that the change is partial, and the conclusion to me is that we're seeing a more modernized form of authoritarianism, even if you more like Putin 2001, 2005, it's very similar to what's happening there. So economy, facade, it looks more sexy, a place, tourism, opening the visa, that's important. Yeah. But long-term, still a dictatorship, if you want.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Luca. So, Bruce, you know, I know you are someone with equally strong roots both in the West and Central Asia. The reason I'm saying that is in our part of the world, especially in Washington, D.C., as Dr. Luca was referring to, we quickly get excited about certain things. You know, why not? Easterners, too, we also get excited because Central Asia has been that place that you often don't hear anything good coming out of there. So when it does, we all jump on it. So my question is, it's almost 2 years since Mirziyayev is in power as the president. Do we know where he is taking Uzbekistan, what kind of Uzbekistan he envisions?
certainly one that has a stronger economy than it does, and that, of course, that involves better trade links than it had. So, you know, I see him, obviously his priority has been on the economy practically since the start, trying to get Uzbekistan kicking into gear. If you're willing to go with that as being his primary motivation, it explains a lot of the changes in Uzbekistan. Of course, he has a better policy with his neighbors. They're always happy to say they're a double landlocked country. If you don't have good relations with your neighbors, it puts you in a pretty hard spot. So that's all to the good. He needed better trade relations with countries much further away, too. You know, let's not forget that, you know, I'm sitting here in Prague. Islam Karimov was supposed to visit here 5 years ago, I think, if I remember right. And the rights record of Uzbekistan and when he was president was so bad that the Czech government finally found this excuse that there was this children's school holiday at the end of February, right when Karimov was scheduled to be there, and all the a bunch of the people from parliament would be gone because they would be with their children on vacation. But this kind of speaks to the unpopularity of the man. I mean, he was toxic for foreign trade. Certainly with the West, they didn't want to have to deal with him at all just because of the record at home. So a lot of this had to be cleaned up before Uzbekistan was going to get back on its feet. And let's face it, there's nothing will breed social discontent faster than severe poverty. We're seeing shades of that in Turkmenistan right now. So for his own sake, for his government's sake, he had to turn the economy around. I want to believe these changes, and I want to believe it's going to lead to something much more substantive in the future. I mean, even Karimov himself used to say economic reform first, then political reform. We haven't even got that far with President Mirziyoyev yet. He's pretty much stressed the economic reform. But, of course, you know, if he can get the economy on its feet so that 1 million or 2 million citizens of Uzbekistan don't have to become migrant laborers from year to year, that would be a plus. It would help stabilize his regime. His policies in the area are certainly, ask any of the neighbors, and I've been through there a lot for many years, you know, I've heard some harsh things about Uzbekistan and neighboring states over the course of the years. And I see that that is not the case anymore. People are much more accepting now and certainly less fearful than they were. So what his long-term strategy is, though, like I said, I really couldn't say because admittedly, he's only been in 2 years. But I haven't seen, for all the changes in the media, what I'd really like to see is a truly independent media outlet will open up sometime, just from journalists. And I'm not talking about, you know, the private media, which is actually owned by a friend of the president. But, you know, like truly, you know, young, independent journalists that are opening up their own media outlet and are able to report about what's going on in the country, that would be a good sign. Next year, we got parliamentary elections. You know, it's asking a lot to ask for an independent political party, maybe. But at least loosen that up and let independents run again. That would be a sign of reform in the right way. But we don't even hear that kind of stuff yet. You know, it's pretty much all the good news is coming from regional relations, foreign relations, and economic news.
Okay, thank you very much, Bruce Panier. So this is the time usually I take a break in our normal podcast, but this is not a really normal podcast, so I'm going to skip the formalities. And get to the audience. So we have microphones. Those who want to ask questions, please come forward, introduce yourself. Here you go, Peter.
I think one of the more interesting stories that we've covered for the last year in Uzbekistan has actually been what is happening with religion. And I think that although you're having a very interesting conversation so far, I think there's another story to do, not with big politics, but with what is happening more at grassroots level in society itself. And what we're seeing with religion is now that the stranglehold has been loosened a little bit, that people are more free to express themselves, and they've expressed themselves in ways that clearly the government is struggling to cope with adequately. And this has come to the forefront, especially over the issue of school uniforms, only in the last few weeks, specifically that the government has introduced rules essentially banning overtly Islamic clothing in the school place. So when a series of bloggers wrote critically about this, they got into trouble for it. And I think this is going to be a really interesting test for Uzbekistan. And I'm wondering from members of the panel how you think the government is going to or should deal with this going forward. And are you hopeful that they will pass, or are you worried that they will flunk this test?
Do you mind me if I invite someone else to answer this question? Steve Sivertlu, I think you guys worked on this project a lot. Do you want to take this question? Steve Sivertlu is the Central Asia Researcher for Human Rights Watch.
No, I think there are more questions than answers when it comes to this very deep tension that was revealed with this recent case of the bloggers being arrested. You had people on social media espousing views. Ostensibly, this was initiated with the introduction of school uniforms, which would ban or exclude the wearing of a hijab in school. And a series of bloggers were advocating religious freedom, some would argue, that it's religious freedom, while also taking the view, some would say, that hijab should be compulsory, or that talking about advocating for a larger role for Islam in Uzbek society, which really strikes at the very heart, you know, of this debate of the future of Uzbekistan, the direction, this tension between secularism and the role of Islam. And of course, it implies a lot, you know, or implicates a lot about women's rights. And of course, this delicate balance. I think Peter's question again, it can't be answered because it's this perennial debate. And you talk with the intelligentsia in Tashkent, and Nabuhor can answer this better than I can. And I think you just get a range of responses. But many people will say that this is a Pandora's box.
I was there when the bloggers case came up. Mm-hmm. So I got there late August, and you know, the country was obviously in the mood of celebrating the Independence Day, remembering Islam Karimov in a kind of a controlled way. And then when this issue came up, it was very interesting to see how divided the public was on this. Now, that Pandora's box you just mentioned, it's already open. We have to recognize that. The issue is one of the hottest topics in Uzbekistan. People don't hide their religious beliefs in public, by the way. They talk about it everywhere. People don't whisper about this anymore. And that's good. But what they are unhappy about is that the tone, the overall underlying policy towards religiosity has not changed. It's as it was during Karimov. Basically, we will remain a strictly secular nation, and we will target anyone who's going to threaten that system. And there are no regulations, there are no written laws about this. There are no laws in Uzbekistan that actually bans hijab or beard, by the way. I mean, I interviewed Minister of Justice, I talked to Kamilov even when they went to Washington to talk about religious freedom in Uzbekistan, and they say we don't ban them. But every institution can come up with its own rules when it comes to them. Everybody, you know, every government, like every company can have their own restrictions on that. So they are playing a very, I would say, a dangerous, very sensitive game here, because President Mirziyoyev and his administration know that Islam is a very, very sensitive factor for the country. And, you know, I see Mirziyoyev is trying every day to win the hearts and minds of the people. He talks, when you listen to him, he talks like he wants to get elected. You know, he's like, he's in a kind of a political campaign, and we see that as a populist move, but I see him as genuinely, you know, trying to really, like, capture the minds of the people. And there are a lot of people who are religious and Uzbekistan, who've sort of been, you know, leading these underground lives. So the Uzbek government will have to figure this out. But we should also mention that there are not every Uzbek is religious. You know, now that Uzbeks are on social media, we now know that there is a group of atheist Uzbeks, and they are running their own, propaganda on social media. You have religious Uzbeks also divided. So the public opinion is very diverse on this, and we're just getting started to discuss this issue. Yeah. And I think it's a very organic process. I think that the society needs to go through that.
Thank you, Nobahar. So, briefly, please.
Yes, very briefly. Just thinking about this issue, like before, I wasn't suggesting that the president didn't have power consolidated. Power is quite consolidated. What we're seeing play out is exactly on these kinds of issues of religion. He's trying to build a consensus, actually trying to figure out where to go. And I think when we are thinking about reform, it's this or it's that, it's modernization, it's authoritarian. I think they're figuring this out right now. I don't think we can actually say one way or the other. I think Mirziyoyev is actually trying to push things along quite far in certain areas, maybe certain areas rather than others. But reform is not a linear process. It is not black and white. And he is trying to build consensus on certain issues, and religion is obviously one, where you're going to have debates behind the scenes about where to push these issues, how far things can be pushed, and that's going to take time. Mm. So we cannot think of this as reform going this way. Reform is not linear.
It happened before. It happened before in the 90s, where in the West we were so excited about the USSR collapsing, they would say that transition was going towards democracy. And in fact, we were wrong. The reformists decided that Antigua was going towards authoritarianism. So if we don't have the right now to say, well, it's getting dead, in 5 years' time, when if this thing doesn't really work out and they return to the Karimov time, we would have missed another chance. So I think that you are right. It's probably too early, but there are, and I think this, as a Central Asia Studies lecturer, I think it's how it's my sort of, it's part of, important part of my job, noting that we're seeing change, but the change is not going in the way in which a lot of people say it is going.
Interesting. Okay. Do we have any other question? Yeah, please go ahead.
Hello. My name is Alex Sulko. I'm an independent researcher from Uzbekistan, from Samarkand. And I've got a very quick question. Living there, I think that the one very obvious reform which you can see is the growing influence of Russia in Uzbekistan. And that is something which worries me a lot, because I think that Uzbekistan, well, I can see evidence of Uzbekistan tying up with Russia in many ways, and that includes the nuclear power station, that includes giving out our airspace to the Russian air forces, and the influx of oligarch money, and all sort of things which are formalized and very informal at the same time. But I'm not actually seeing much of the analysis of that and of those risks involved in that. Mm. So maybe it's all kind of an exaggerated sort of impression, or maybe it's something real which is going on and we don't see. Mm. So I would like to hear some kind of qualified opinion on
that's
that.
That's an interesting point. Mm. I was also looking into this. Just add to your point, recently Vladimir Putin was in Uzbekistan. He signed like a couple of contracts, and the contract signed between these two leaders reached to $25 billion.
27
billion dollars. So I'm not an economist, but it's a huge number. I'm not sure if Uzbekistan's contracts with the entire world combined reached to this point. So who wants to take this question? Bruce, you are quiet. Do you want to comment on this?
Sure. No problem. I actually, Russian-Uzbek relations, kind of ebb and flow over the years, and that's always been true. There's been times where Uzbekistan's gotten much closer to Russia and then moved much farther away under Karimov. So I'm not surprised. Uzbekistan is opening up to a lot of countries, and why not Russia? You mentioned the nuclear power station that they're building, but, really, who else would give them money and help for that, if you think about it, right? China's played out financially in Central Asia. There are no more big projects that China's interested in investing in Central Asia, at least that I see anymore. They've already put sunk their money into the projects they want. Some token investment here and there, but they're pretty much done. So who's going to pay it for a $10 billion nuclear power station? And of course, Rosatom is the biggest company in the world as far as constructing nuclear power stations. So that kind of makes sense. Uzbekistan is tied to Russia for military arms. They're still using Russian, Soviet-made weapons in some cases, but certainly Russian-made weapons after that. So, where else are they going to get those weapons? So they're going to have to deal with Russia. And again, I get back to the point of economy, that simply Mirziyoyev really wants to jumpstart this economy and get it going in the right direction. It solves a lot of his problems, certainly a lot of his near-term problems. And Russia's willing to put up some money at the moment. Like I said, China is not going to – they're done spending billions of dollars on big projects in Central Asia. They got them. And the West is not going to sink that kind of money in yet, because even the most optimistic people still got to wonder a little bit about where we're going here. So, that leaves Russia. And, and Mirziyoyev is making the best out of that. For Uzbekistan, having good relations with Russia is not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't mean that Uzbekistan will jump into the Russian camp and join the Collective Security Treaty Organization and the Eurasian Economic Union and those things. It just means that, they want better relations with all countries in general, and Russia's an old partner that at the moment, although it's hard to see where they're getting the money from, but anyway, they're promising a lot of money.
Hmm. When a government opens its own economy globally, well, originally, as it is, sometimes you had to make these pacts with, what we could consider unsavory partners. To me, what is interesting is that this relationship with Russia, on the one hand, shows that the great game narrative never had any sense in Central Asia, because they have been able to play all the cards that they want. It continues on, it goes back to that kind of, multi-vector tradition. But also, especially if you look at the deal that they did in terms of the EU, the Economic Union, having those fruits and vegetables flying straight into Russia actually showed that this EU, which is Putin's geopolitical pact, is nothing more than just a joke. So I think that having more trade with Russia is part of this kind of economic, if you want, startup that it's doing. But it's also, no, I wouldn't agree with Putin that I wouldn't really be too alarmed, at least now. Because now we have different kind of criteria to decide whether or not there is the transformation to a client state. That is one. And we see it with China. I haven't seen that kind of things yet. Or unduly influenced when it comes to social policies, you know, which we haven't heard that one yet. So Russia dictating what to do in Uzbekistan. So it is something which we have to be watching, but it's not there yet.
You know, Russian, Steve Severlo is there. He definitely is going to ask something rights-related question, but increasing influence of Russia on Uzbekistan, even on economy. It has lots of dimensions. It's not going to be limited with economy.
Can I add to that?
I think there's actually something really important to say about Russia here that we're not thinking about. Think about the issue of migrant laborers from Central Asia. And it goes back to Bruce's point about the economy. When I'm talking to government officials, they are very concerned about these economic issues. If you're Mirziyoyev and you're concerned about economic growth and unemployment, and that's what people in Tashkent and the regions, that's what they're talking about, more than they're talking about political reforms, they're worried about jobs, they're worried about inflation, they're worried about their pocketbooks. Mm-hmm. Mirziyoyev is worried about that too. He's worried about these fundamental issues. And so you see so many Uzbeks going to Russia. How does this Rosatom, $11 billion investment to build a nuclear power station that would provide 30% of the country's power? Okay? This migration issue becomes important because I think many people, and government officials have told me this, they see Russia as the source of extremism. And why provide jobs inside of Uzbekistan? This is something that the government is very concerned about, providing employment here, because they see Russia actually as not Uzbekistan as the source of extremism or Islam within Uzbekistan as a source of instability. It's actually coming from Russia.
There is a lot of discussion about Russia within the public. Again, going back to social media, which is quite vibrant increasingly, despite the fact that it's blocked and access to the internet is really difficult from Uzbekistan, what you asked is very much discussed within the Uzbek speaking, you know, populations. And local media, regional media, central media, they also talk about this. There is some Russian language media, of course, but that's a lot for Uzbekistan. You didn't have these kind of discussions. I mean, we might be expecting too much when we want. You know, there is this anti-Russian sentiment is very evident. And there are pro-Russians too, and there is a clash between them. And within the government, actually, people don't hide their dislike or fear of Russians either. And speaking of all these contracts, a lot of it has not been delivered yet. Last year, President Mirziyoyev signed up to like $16 billion worth of contracts. Most of it have not been delivered. Tashkent is actually very frustrated. So there is politics here, and then there is real policy. And when it comes to delivering, I mean, China has not delivered a lot of what it has promised. The government of Uzbekistan is incredibly frustrated about the lack of real investment. Papers are good, but they're not delivering. So I don't think we should really get too excited about all these promises.
Okay. Let's see what Steve is excited about.
You know, if the question of the panel, the fundamental question is, you know, how sustainable are the reforms? Are positive changes still on the horizon? I think roughly half the panel, Muhammad and Luca, are, let's say, cautiously pessimistic, and Jen and Nabuhor are cautiously optimistic. I count myself probably among the cautiously optimistic group, and Bruce amazingly manages to stay right down the middle, as always. But my question, I guess, would be first to Luca, but to the whole panel, if we take the cautiously pessimistic view, that essentially we're driving towards a modernized, not free Uzbekistan. In this equation, does anything change for you? And I think, Jen, as a political science view, what about the role of an honest and open, here's what I'm pushing for as a human rights activist, honest and open discussion of history, introduction of an examination of the past. Is that the missing ingredient? Is that the essential ingredient that could ensure a different kind of dynamism? We see the economic dynamism. We do see the rising expectations. I feel the hope among a lot of people I meet within Uzbekistan for change. But maybe the other ingredient that is necessary is history, of revisiting somehow what happened under Karimov for 25 years. My theory has been that there was, even among the very top, there was an exhaustion level, there was a fatigue that they associated with Karimov that sort of liberated them when he died and to a certain extent. And if you can capitalize on that, if you can keep that memory of the repression in a way alive, it may drive or it may help sustain progressive thinking. So I want you to elaborate, if you can, one of you or all of you, about how you would see that. How important is that? Or am I overplaying that factor that of education and of history?
One person is going to elaborate on that because we have more questions to be addressed. So who's that? Who's the person?
My point is that I regard what the president has been doing in a discrete range of areas as the most important project we see in Central Asia now. And this relates to opening up the borders, opening up new bus lines, new train lines, new plane lines. It's actually making the life of ordinary Central Asians better. And this, to me, is what matters. My observations about modernizing, it comes to seeing its intentions. If you have a list of 28 people who signed up the necrologue, the obituary of the president, and you choose to run against candidates who were external to that, so people that no one knew in the country, it means that your intention was to have an election that was no free, no fair. It means that you're in control, and it means that you're having a set of reforms which do not intend to improve qualitative the governance of the country. So that's my main observation. So nor did I hear talk about let's assess together as a community what the prior regime did. I never heard of that. Nor did I hear any kind of talk to seeing, well, we are Uzbekistan, how do we compare to the other states in the region? So what we have is it's an authoritarian opening which is controlled, and it happening in a way that to me suggests that things are not going to improve in the sort of liberalization area. I haven't heard the same kind of things which I've seen anywhere in other systems that have opened. You know, as a political scientist, you try to understand this comparatively. And it's to try this and it's comparatively, to me, I'm seeing very much the same thing that we see in the 90s. And religion is the same thing, if you think. Try to compare how the Central Asia leaders talked about religion in 92, 95, and you see a lot of those vocabulary being translated into today's Uzbekistan. Opportunistic, made with a legitimacy agenda in mind. So there is one thing, though, which could turn the balance here, is that if that kind of opening stops to being controlled, and if there are forces, influences, and this is the work that you guys are doing, it's very important. If there are that kind of opening up that allows the peculation of a number of positive influences, that's what we'll see. So to me, this is important, because in the last 4 or 5 years of what Karimov was, I saw the kind of isolation that I only saw in the Kingdom of Turkmenistan. And that's the kind of complete block of the country. Whereas now it's opening up. So if they're able to control the opening up, then it's just modernization. If there is some areas in which you see, just the last thing, and then I'm going to shut up, I promise. If there is change, it's not going to be linear. There could be peaks and troughs, and because that's how it is. So what I'm advocating, I guess, is a little bit more sophisticated analysis, a little bit of understanding of what is going on, rather than just say, oh, you know, it's going to get super, or something like that. That's what I'm advocating.
We absolutely need to look into this, you know, deeper. I interviewed many Uzbeks and asked them this question, like, how are you remembering, what do you think of Islam Karimov now that you have this, right? I mean, now you're, you know, 2 years into this regime. And many young Uzbeks who are actually, like, critical thinking Uzbeks told me, you know, we don't have that sober of a mind to actually talk about Karimov because we are so emotionally attached to what was happening. So in many ways, Uzbeks are not ready to discredit, you know, like not to be too sentimental or emotional. They're not ready for that. And forget it. When it comes to the government, they are not going to start that yet. They are not prepared or they are not willing to discredit President Karimov, his doings. What is happening is that they're going to indirectly discredit him by changing the policies that, you know, that I mean, and President Mirziyoyev has talked a lot about things that, you know, for example, President Karimov used to say that we are the equals, you know, we're the equal among equals, you know, the international community loves us, we're such an important player, and President Mirziyoyev comes up and says, nobody cares about us in the international community, we have zero respect in the international community. So you will see those kind of maneuvering, you know, actions, perhaps, you know, but they are not going to open that box that you want, okay. So not yet.
Thank you, Novahar. Just briefly.
So I look at this issue of rural poverty. I'm going to bring this up again. It's still a heavily rural country. Mirziyoyev is talking about poor people and how the government has not served you. What does that mean? I mean, yes, it's indirect. The government didn't care about you.
Yes. he's not seeing that this is not something that President, when I was the Prime Minister and when Assam Karim was President, we didn't do
right.
it.
Right. I lived in Samarkand when he was the governor of Samarkand, and he was a tough character. He had a really tough reputation, right? And I think we just can't forget that this reform is not a linear process. We are seeing a lot of things. I don't think we can say right now what the government announced: direct election of Mahalla leaders. That's going to happen in May next year. The government is talking about elections of hakims. If you look at laws and decrees being passed that deal with service delivery, there's a lot of language sowing the seeds for major decentralization. If you just look at what's being written down, has any of this been implemented? No. But I think we need to remind ourselves for a second about the things that we care about and what we're hearing and what's being communicated to domestic audiences. And it's a very different thing, and that's what, I'm not Pollyannish. I was out of Uzbekistan for many years, and it was heartbreaking. But if we look at what's being communicated, what the issues the government's working on, they don't know where these reforms are going, but this issue of poverty and problems is a damning critique of the previous regime, and it's not subtle at all.
Okay, so slogans, nice speeches are mm-hmm. good. When we look into the substance, if you can please give me with the concrete numbers, what he has done to improve this unemployment situation in the country, the power. I heard him saying, let's create chicken farms, banana gardens, things like that.
Fish.
Has anything changed?
The lack of investment, that the kind of investment that he expected would come in has not come in. And President Mirziyoyev is the most, disappointed person in this, really. And if you are following the whole thing, he's not talking much lately. He doesn't do the kind of speeches that he was doing around this time last year. Every week he would go somewhere, he would have video selector after video selector, live, and all these big statements, headlines. We don't have that anymore. And when you listen to him, I listened to him on Independence Day when he was meeting other presidents. He's quite open in saying that we have not delivered. Like, we promised a lot. The labor market has not improved. We're not doing well economically. He has not delivered there. If you are asking for delivery, he has not. And he's basically talking about that openly, too.
That's what we should be talking about, right? I mean, talking is one thing. I could promise whatever. Yeah.
So trying to get foreign investment isn't just talking. It's that's real. Has that reduced unemployment?
No.
The jury's still out, right? This kind of thing takes time. But if you look at, for example, the chicken farms, the fish, there's a big program. And if you talk to people in Uzbekistan right now, there's a program called Abod Kishlok, Abod Mahalla. It's about
development
in communities and generating employment. It's not just about development. It's about generating jobs. And the government's approach to these issues, chicken and fish, and this top-down models of government investment, I think what you're seeing is the government wants to address these issues, but the way that it addresses them is in very old ways. The means, the tools, the policy tools that it uses, it sees we all share a common goal, right? It's reducing unemployment, but how do you reduce unemployment? Well, unemployment must come from a government investment program because that's what we've done for 80, 90 years, 100 years, right? It's central planning, it's government investment, and these are the tools that you use to reduce unemployment. Changing those kinds of things will take time.
So it's about economic development then?
Of course. Well,
his priority is that. Economic development is a priority for Mirziyoyev.
You can't separate them.
He's doing very successfully. Say, we are new. The prior regime didn't help you, even though he was the prime minister. It wasn't actually, it was important in the prior regime.
They'll even go further in saying, they'll say, 2 years ago, we didn't even know the size of our economy. World Bank and IMF now tell us that they are going to help us to actually come up with that analysis.
Yeah.
And World Bank and IMF, which has been working, they've been working very closely with the Uzbek government, they see the government still doesn't know the size of the informal economy. They now know there is a figure now about how many people in Uzbekistan are actually formally employed.
With all due respect, most politicians, they care about economic reform. Whether it's in the United States or in Uzbekistan, those are the issues. So is it economic reform or political reform? You can't separate those two. Why introduce direct elections for Mahalla leaders? Why talk about election of Hakimiyat officials? Why talk about issues like decentralization? Of course it's for economic prosperity issues.
The regional proxies, though, show that even if you introduce those elections at local level, Kazakhstan is the best example, very easy to corrupt them straight away.
Well, look at China. China, that's another regional example, and I think that's a regional example that the government's much more interested in following than Kazakhstan.
I think what you would hear from the government would be that the SUM is now convertible. Now convertibility is open, and our system has not collapsed. So that's our main success in this field. That's what
they say. Let's move on. Thank you very much. Is there any other question? Please grab a microphone.
I'm Mehmet Ulyanov from AC Bishkek. My question is related to, for quite a long time, Uzbekistan was considered to be a stumbling block for intra-regional relations. And now things are changing, of course, and there's a lot of expectations within the region as well in this regard. And my question is that what is stake from within Uzbekistan on that? And how is this perspective from the country else affect internal reforms?
I think it's very important. I mean, in terms of actual change, that's probably the most important dimension. I mean, it is geographically the central state. It shares border with all the other states. It is very big as well. And if you look, you know, like, this isn't about creating a central union, but just a minimum decent level of cooperation cannot work unless the two big economies cooperate with each other, and that's Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. In the Karimov years, the data was so ridiculous, I'm not even going to mention it. Mutual trade and investment were actually quite embarrassing. So that can only be called a big good. And it was that kind of context in which it's Uzbekistan's fault, the Kazakhstan's fault. I think they equal responsibility there. But having big emerging economy that is willing to cooperate with its own neighbors is actually probably the most important success this achieved so far. And again, connectivity. This connectivity doesn't have to be about long-term, you know, long-haul railway from Beijing to Essex. It has to be about allowing the people across the border can cross the border an easy way. And it's been doing that. So to me, that's what I can see from where I am, it is successful in that sense.
So the Uzbekistan's point man to the region, and not many people know about this, is Ilhom Ne'matov, who was sacked after his ambassadorship in Washington 4 years ago. He went back, and for a time he became the deputy foreign minister, and then he retired. Then as soon as Mirziyoyev came back, he brought him back, and he made him the point man on Central Asia. And I interviewed him on the record, off the record. We had long conversations. He's got his team now. And he will tell you that it's been a journey for the Uzbek government. 2 years ago, when they started talking about we want to have good relations with the neighbors, they did not expect the enormity of the issues. So starting with like border issues, trans-border trade, all kinds of issues with every government, that borders Uzbekistan, they feel exhausted already. But they're quite optimistic because the feedback from the neighboring countries have been really good. And Uzbeks themselves did not expect how much support they were going to get from their neighbors and from the international community on their initiatives. So while at the beginning it was like a new page, let's be friends with our neighbors, now they're sitting on a pile of issues that they feel the calling for, we need to solve this. This is all because of us, and this is all because of our wrongdoings perhaps, and now we have to really deal with them one by one. I mean, that's where Uzbekistan is. And again, they don't have the money to realize a lot of those projects.
Thank you very much. I think, Peter, let's have just a final question from you, then we need to really move on.
I just wanted to contribute one last note on this point, and I'm sorry, I don't envy whoever has to edit this podcast. I would just offer, as a slight response to the previous questioner, a couple of kind of anecdotal points. And first of all, I think an interesting sort of little case to watch as far as trade and inter-regional relations are these trade shows that Uzbekistan will sometimes do in neighboring countries, and that vice versa, neighboring countries will do in Uzbekistan. So, I mean, I'm most aware of Tajikistan because this is a country I've lived in the last few months. And there, what you've seen is essentially Uzbekistan has pursued this autarkic model of building all of this kind of medium and large enterprises which can produce all of these domestic goods. And yet, there's not a sufficient market inside Uzbekistan to actually maintain the existence of these companies. So I think there's a very pragmatic goal here, which is they want to get their fridges and they want to get their cars and their televisions and their air conditioners and sell them in Tajikistan and sell them in Kyrgyzstan. And I think that's one of the primary goals that Uzbekistan has actually in integrating its economy with those of its neighbors. But then there's a rather sort of a quirky little sort of unexpected consequence of this, as we at Eurasianet did a story about the ways in which shuttle traders in southern Kyrgyzstan in Osh are actually taking domestic goods in the other direction, so they get stuff from China. And so what Uzbek people will tell you is that even if a television costs $20 less than one produced inside Uzbekistan, or air conditioners are a very popular item, even if they cost $15 less brought in by a shuttle trader from Kyrgyzstan, then they would rather buy it that way. And this has kind of spooked the Uzbek authorities so much so that they actually sought to introduce restrictions into how much stuff could come in. Mm-hmm. So I think that was just what I wanted to say about the kind of the rather conflicted position that Uzbekistan has regarding trade with its neighbors.
Okay. Thank you very much, Peter Leonard, the Central Asia correspondent for Eurasia Net. Okay, so we are already over time, and let's conclude this with a couple of points, brief as much as possible, with the future-facing expectations, prospects for change. What I'm looking for going forward is, like, recently Mirziyoyev has gone through a transformation-level changes by bringing new generation into the system. There are many ways to look into this. One way is also that he's creating his own loyal team.
Of course.
Where he goes with this. And also, I cannot miss the other fact that one son-in-law is chief of the presidential security, the other son-in-law is chief of the presidential administration.
No, he's not. His other son-in-law is not the chief of the administration.
Okay, that's what I read yesterday. Mm-hmm. Remove that. So he's creating his own loyal team, where he goes with this. And also, there are a couple of individuals like members of organized crime. They are coming back to Uzbekistan. One is Ghafur Rahimov. He could not be seen in Uzbekistan, the Karimov, but not only came back, he is president of International Box Federation or Association. And then Salim Abdullayev is another person, member of organized crime. He is back too, and he's also in the position of authority. He's the chief of Uzbekistan's Wrestling Federation. What Mirziyoyev has in mind when he is letting these things happen. And also, I'm looking into corruption. Uzbekistan has always been on the list of countries which are known with the corruption. It's also kind of encouraging to see that in the first half of 2017, around some 1,600 cases were filed against allegedly corrupt officials, which looks good. But in the meantime, he brought Aripov as a prime minister, who is known colluding with the daughter of the former president, Gulnara Karimova, in her corruption cases. What he is trying to achieve by this. I think I should stop with that. So just a couple of brief future-facing prospects.
I want to make just one point about the elite, because I studied it. So you're right, creating his own loyalty is ruling the elite in a much less personalist way than Karimov was towards the end. If you look at average tenure when Karimov died, we had people in place for 11, 12 years. So, extremely long.
Mirziyoyev himself had been there since 2003.
So very long. So he's doing that. Obviously, there have been significant purges in the what they call the power ministry, the power sectors, the police force. I only have one question, is the current elite qualified enough to run the ambitious program the president has? Is there enough human capital to sustain this kind of change down to the line? It's not about just the minister, but can the minister have people qualified at the regional and local level? Is there enough capital for that? I'm not sure. I spoke with people, the juries out there. I would query that there is enough now. You would say no. So obviously this is not an obstacle. It's that if you have a very ambitious agenda, but you cannot find people who can execute it to the way in which you want it, then this agenda gets somehow the tour.
And that's the main struggle now.
Yeah.
That's the number one challenge.
Okay. So very brief points about future-facing prospects for change.
We have to think. So when we talk about Salim and Ghafur, and we talk about...
This was my thought. So
I think we have to think of this as in a whole, right? Like it's so easy to apply labels to what's happening, but you can't take this issue out of context with the editor Fergana Rue and Nabahor coming back to Uzbekistan. We have to take this as a picture. It's a broad picture. And what we're seeing are many different interests being pitted against each other, debates taking place about these issues. So if it was just those two coming back, there would be Alisher Usmanov is back. There's a lot of people coming back, and it's diverse, and these are debates that are going to
be
happening.
But these are different people, in the context we are talking about.
Of course, so we're seeing this concern about corruption at the highest level. You hear the president talk about corruption. You see administrative reforms designed to mete out corruption, and I think one of the reasons they want to have elections to have hakims much more accountable to citizens in order to get rid of corruption, because that's what the president is talking about. He's saying it's the hakims are corrupt. You're seeing this corruption at the local level. We need to get rid of this, and it's easy to throw the hakims under the bus, right? Unless there's more genuine political competition, those hakims are still going to be accountable to the central government. So it's a complicated picture, and for any of us to sit up here and say, we know what's going to happen, we don't. We don't know the trajectory. These things are still playing out. But what I'm encouraged by are the debates and the diverse actors who are now part of this discussion. Let's hope it becomes more diverse and more people can return and more voices can be heard. But if you can go to a Gaishnik and take a video of him shaking you down for a bribe and post that on Facebook, that was unthinkable 3 years ago. And it happens all the time now. Just that matter of fact, being able to do that kind of thing, I think is no small step for people's dignity. And I think that's an important thing for us to remember.
I mean, obviously, Uzbekistan has a lot of issues, and all of these issues are very much interdependent. Their solutions are interdependent. They're very much, interrelated. And there are a lot of things that we don't know, but what we know now is the lack of human capital, this human capital that Uzbekistan used to brag about for years and years. It's not there. There is no expertise, very little know-how. The number one challenge for the government now is actually to be able to execute some of that reform agenda and be able to find the funds and then the people to do this. They've been trying to attract people like me, basically, those that are outside, to come in, and there isn't much trust there. So you need to build trust. You need to build mutual respect. For that, you need a huge coordination body, which Uzbekistan doesn't have yet. They have the reform agenda, but they don't have a policy on how to coordinate this whole process. There is no reform team. There are people who are sort of, who are ministers and who are Mirziyoyev's loyal soldiers, but they're not standing up there as the faces of reform. Uzbekistan needs a reform team. It's not there. Another big problem is, again, everybody leans on President Mirziyoyev. That's a huge minus.
That's his fault too, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course, yeah. And this curious selection of people around him just tells me that he's a strategist, he's a chess player. Just because he has some people close to him doesn't mean that he wants to work with them or trusts in them or thinks they're good, but that's also his strategy to keep them, nearby. Because all of these people represent networks. Mm-hmm. They represent interests. I think that's basically his political savviness.
Okay.
That's a part of his strategy.
Great.
But I think coordination is very important. Being able to attract Uzbeks from the outside, to be able to build trust so that they come and help, or help from the outside. I think those are the major challenges. But I think to convince some of the big investors to come in would be a huge win for Mirziyoyev right now.
Thank you very much, Nobahar. Bruce, your expectation about future-facing change in Uzbekistan, what are they?
Well, I think President Mirziyoyev has picked his reforms. I would imagine we're going to continue with this economic reform as long as it takes to get the country going. I mean, future Uzbekistan is probably the military power in Central Asia. It is an economic power in Central Asia. I don't see it supplanting Kazakhstan anytime in the near future. It will never be the island of democracy in Central Asia anytime soon. That's for sure. And, concerning the anti-corruption and always kind of wary about this criminal element. There's a lot of questions about who Mirziyoyev's support base is. Who are the people that are helping prop him up in power? How did he get rid of both the Rustam? So, of course, I'm a little uneasy when I see that there's people that are in the underworld who at least support Mirziyoyev, seem to fairly openly. I have no idea what his ties are to them, but it is unnerving a little bit. As for the anti-corruption thing, I don't know. This could be just a case of those corrupt officials were the other guy's corrupt officials, and I want my own guys in. I mean, I've seen this stuff a lot in Central Asia over the years, and too often that's the result of it, is they get these people out there and say, here's a corrupt official that we caught, and the guy that replaces him is a friend or associate of the president. He does pretty much the same thing, but it's just a different guy. And then the one last thing, this kind of gets back to Steve's point about further reforming and reviewing history and what went wrong. The more the economic reforms take root and the more they kind of succeed, I imagine you'll see a lot more criticism of the old regime. There's a lot of records that need to be sanitized because Mirziyoyev was prime minister for 13 years. under that. So I don't see there'll never be a full review of history. But that might be what it would take, something along those lines, to get to the point where we actually start to see some domestic political reforms happening that are more substantive. Although, that said, it might be enough for the Uzbek people in the near term and even midterm if the economy is running better and there's economic opportunities they didn't have before. That might be enough for now.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier. I think we could be discussing more points, but we are already over time. So with this, thank you very much.
Thank you for coming to Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.